From time to time, since its earliest organized days, the craft has been criticized, attacked, or satirized in the media and books. The attacks in the 1980s were by no means a new thing, but what was new was their vehemence and the great amount of interest that they stirred up. Why the attack should have surfaced at this time is something of a mystery. The catalyst was probably the publication of Stephen Knight's The Brotherhood, a supposedly long-researched, serious and impartial study of Freemasonry, but containing many factual errors, a great deal of third-hand rumour and speculation, and gross exaggerations. Why the public and the media took such a great interest in such a mediocre book was probably the result of the intense privacy in which the craft had conducted its affairs over the previous 40 years. For reasons now not known, the craft at the end of the 1930s began to become very introspective, to the extent that, over the years, the general public lost contact with it, and it began to appear in their eyes as a vast, secretive organization. Prior to the outbreak of the Second World War, the situation was very different. Reports of Masonic meetings and information on Masonic personalities appeared regularly in the national and local press. There were two weekly Masonic newspapers, The Freemason and The Freemason's Chronicle, and a monthly magazine, The Masonic Record, which were available from newsagents and station bookstalls, all three reporting meetings and other Masonic events in great detail, as well as carrying articles on all manner of Masonic subjects. Until 1984, the official response to anti-Masonic comment was one of no comment, which may in itself have contributed to the distancing of the craft from public life. That attitude of no comment came under review by the Grand Master himself, who signalled a limited change in his address to Grand Lodge at the annual investiture held on the 25th of April 1984. After commenting on Knight's book, the likelihood of investigations by religious groups, and the growing interest in Freemasonry by local authorities, the Grand Master suggested that it was time to look again at the traditional no-comment policy of Grand Lodge in response to outside criticisms and comment. He stressed that he was not advocating an active public relations campaign, but expressed his belief that Freemasonry should do more to prepare itself to respond to genuine inquiries about Freemasonry and what it stands for. The Grand Master's comments and suggestions were immediately taken into consideration by the Board of General Purposes, and resulted in a number of organisations who were contemplating holding inquiries into Freemasonry being agreeably surprised when they were invited to meet senior members of the craft to discuss the subject. To help brethren explain Freemasonry, the Board produced four leaflets: What is Freemasonry?, Freemasonry and Religion, Freemasonry and Society, and Freemasonry's External Relations, and a half-hour video, The Freemasons. The Grand Secretary, Commander Michael Higham, and myself as Grand Lodge's librarian and curator, appeared on radio and television as official spokesmen, and many journalists found themselves being invited to discuss Freemasonry. Further, critics in the media now found that factual errors in their comments no longer went uncorrected. Criticism of Freemasonry falls into four main areas: that it is a secret society, that it is a religion, substitute for religion, or that it is anti-Christian, that it exists solely to further the material or social interests of its members, and that it is a conspiracy secretly manipulating government and the law at all levels. Freemasonry is neither a secret society, nor, as it has sometimes been characterized, a society with secrets. The only secrets in Freemasonry are the traditional words and signs of recognition used as a proof of membership. As a careful reading of the obligation taken in each degree shows, these are the only secrets that a Freemason binds himself to keep. He does not, as has been claimed by some anti-Masonic writers, bind himself not to reveal his membership, not to discuss Freemasonry in any way with a non-Mason, or to protect a fellow Freemason regardless of the circumstances. On the contrary, a Freemason is at perfect liberty to declare his membership to anyone he chooses, has the freedom to discuss Freemasonry, accepting the traditional secrets, with anyone he cares to, and although he obligates himself to protect the honour, reputation and confidences of a fellow Freemason, it is a promise strongly qualified by the following statement: murder, treason, felony, and all other offences contrary to the laws of God and the ordinances of the realm, being at all times most especially accepted. It is a strange secret society that publishes its constitutions and regulations, which can readily be purchased over the counter at Freemasons' Hall. It is an equally strange secret society whose meeting places are easily identified, either by their exterior decoration or from having the words Masonic Hall over their doors or on a brass plate on the doorway, and which are listed in telephone and street directories. So secret is it that members of the public can walk into its London headquarters, visit its library and museum, and be taken on a conducted tour of the Grand Temple and Ceremonial Suite. Can one really call an organisation a secret society, which keeps minutes of its meetings at all levels, those of the Grand, Provincial and District Grand Lodges being printed by outside printers, and issues for circulation amongst members a Grand Lodge yearbook and provincial yearbooks, listing lodges and chapters with their meeting dates and places and lists of members, again produced by outside printers. That Freemasonry as an institution and individual Freemasons value their privacy is another matter, but does not make the institution a secret society. Grand Lodge has always declined to publish a complete membership list, believing that as Freemasonry is a voluntary organisation, the privacy of its members must be respected, and that if anyone wishes to publish their membership, that is a matter for the individual and not the business of Grand Lodge. In this, it is in the same position, although larger numbers are involved, as any other institution, society or club whose members are there by choice, and which similarly neither publish lists of members nor reveal details of membership without the consent of the members concerned. In this computer age, with its necessary regulations concerning data protection, there is a great deal of doubt as to whether or not Grand Lodge has authority to publish a list of members without the consent of each member being obtained. Add to that the practical problems of producing such an enormous list, nearly 360,000 names, and the large expenditure in terms of time and money involved in producing a list, which is by its nature out of date before it's completed, and you have the reasons why, in addition to respect for privacy, Grand Lodge does not publish a membership list. As the compiler of an article in City Limits found to his cost, when he identified a name in the list of Grand Officers in the Grand Lodge yearbook with the chairman of one of the major clearing banks, who happened to have the same surname and initials, a list of names without a great deal of additional information is of little use. Attacks on English Freemasonry on religious grounds have been made periodically over the last 300 years, varying from sermons by individual clergymen to the total ban on membership by the Roman Catholic Church and the recent reports by the Methodist Conference in 1985 and the General Synod of the Church of England in 1987. The first papal bull against Freemasonry was issued in 1738 and did not attack the craft purely on religious grounds, but claimed that by having secrets known only to Masons, it offended against the relationship between a Roman Catholic and his priest, from whom he should have no secrets. Later papal bulls attacked Freemasonry on grounds of anti-clericalism and political involvement, confusing a number of European political associations which had adopted quasi-Masonic trappings with regular Freemasonry. Having consistently opposed Freemasonry since 1738, the penalty under canon law for being a Freemason being excommunication, the Roman Catholic Church's attitude became somewhat blurred after Pope John XXIII's Second Vatican Council. To clarify the subject, the then Pro Grand Master, Earl Cadogan, wrote to the Archbishop of Westminster and received a reply enclosing a statement issued in 1974 by the Roman Catholic Bishops of England and Wales on the subject. In essence, the statement acknowledged that English Freemasonry was not an organisation working against the Church, and stated the bishop's belief that if a Roman Catholic sincerely believed that membership of Freemasonry did not conflict with his deeper loyalty to the Church, and provided that he discussed the matter with his bishop, there was no reason why he should not join. Thus, the attitude of the United Grand Lodge since 1974 has been that, provided a Roman Catholic is satisfied in his own conscience that his joining Freemasonry will not compromise his religious beliefs and will not produce conflict within his immediate family, then there is no reason, because he satisfies the inalienable qualification of a belief in the Supreme Being, why he should not be accepted into the craft. Matters became somewhat muddied when canon law was revised in the late 1970s. The new canon made no reference at all to Freemasonry, and Catholics believed that the old objections had been dropped. Cardinal Ratzinger, prefect of the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, quickly published an unsigned article in L'Osservatore Romano for the 5th of December 1985, stating that although Freemasonry was not explicitly mentioned in the new canon, it was implicitly there as an organisation which worked against the Church. He added that local ecclesiastical authorities had no power to vary the ban, but Roman Catholic bishops in many parts of the world continue to follow the line adopted by the English bishops in 1974. The report of the Faith and Works Committee of the Methodist Conference and its adoption by that conference in July 1985 came as a shock to the many Methodists who were also Freemasons. The committee had been asked to inquire into the compatibility of Freemasonry and Methodism. Rather than doing this, they concentrated on public misconceptions of Freemasonry and recommended that Methodists who were Freemasons and those who were thinking of becoming Masons should think very carefully about membership of the order. They also recommended a ban on Masonic meetings in Methodist premises, a rather empty gesture as no lodge meetings were held in Methodist premises. The principal criticism from Methodists themselves were that the report dealt not with the nature of Freemasonry, but popular misconceptions of it, that the committee had been composed solely of non-Masons and had done its job in a hurry, that few Methodists who were Freemasons had been consulted or asked to give evidence, and that there were far more important matters that the conference should have been debating instead of attacking an institution which had always supported religion. The post-conference issues of the Methodist Recorder, which treated both sides with great fairness in their reporting of the debate, contained many letters from Masons and non-Masons criticising the report. Not unnaturally, the adoption of the report caused great distress to Methodists who were Freemasons and their families. They were not, however, content to let matters rest. An association of Methodist Freemasons was formed, which lobbied at all levels within the Church, and presented a public exhibition on Freemasonry in the town in which successive conferences were held. Their work was rewarded at the 1993 conference when a large number of memorials were presented to conference, resulting in the 1985 report being referred back for further examination. In the wake of the Methodist report, the General Synod of the Church of England in 1985 set up a working group to inquire into the compatibility of Freemasonry and Christianity. Unlike the Methodists, the Synod included two Freemasons on its working party and took a great deal of evidence from Grand Lodge and other Masonic authorities. Having done all it thought possible to explain Freemasonry to the Synod working party, and having answered all the direct questions received, Grand Lodge was all the more dismayed when the working party's contribution to discussion, as it termed its report, was published and accused the craft of four types of heresy and the Royal Arch of blasphemy. The contribution to discussion stopped short of actually declaring Freemasonry incompatible with Christianity, and contrary to press reports, did not demand that Anglicans withdrew from Freemasonry. It did cause a great deal of distress to many Freemasons and their families, who were devoted Anglicans and great supporters of their local churches. The contribution to discussion was debated for 3 hours at the General Synod in York in June 1987, and was adopted and recommended for discussion within the church by a large majority. The craft took the synod at its word and has continued to discuss Freemasonry at all levels within the church, finding that it has rather more friends within the church than the synod. The media had a field day with both the Methodist and the synod reports. The accuracy of their reporting left a great deal to be desired, claiming, completely without foundation, that both churches had banned their members from being Freemasons. Sadly, when in 1986 the General Assembly of the United Reformed Church debated Freemasonry and made no adverse criticisms of it, the press were noticeably silent. The question of the relationship between Freemasonry and religion had been brought before the Board of General Purposes, causing them to lay before Grand Lodge a policy statement agreed on the 12th of December 1962 and reconfirmed on the 9th of December 1981. Knowing that some churches were to investigate Freemasonry, the statement was again looked at, and a leaflet, Freemasonry and Religion, was produced as an official statement on the subject. The leaflet plainly states that Freemasonry is neither a religion nor a substitute for religion, that it requires every member to have a belief in a supreme being, but bans the discussion of religion at Masonic meetings. It denies the existence of a composite Masonic god, or that Freemasonry is an attempt to join religions together. It stresses that Freemasonry has no theological doctrine, offers no sacraments, and does not claim to lead its members to salvation by good works, secret knowledge, or any other means. It emphasizes that a Freemason must follow his own faith and place his duty to God above all other duties. The imputation that men join Freemasonry for material or social gain is of comparatively recent date in Masonic history, and first arose in the late 19th century. To join Freemasonry for this reason is to go against all that it stands for. Indeed, on a number of occasions, from his initial interview until he receives his Grand Lodge certificate on the completion of his taking the 3 degrees, a Mason is asked for a categorical declaration that such is not the reason for his joining. He is firmly told that any attempt to use his membership for material or social gain is contrary to the principles and tenets of the craft. Before he is admitted to the lodge for initiation, he signs a declaration which includes a statement that material gain is not his reason for seeking admission. On his entry to the lodge, he is asked to publicly make that declaration. And when he is presented with his Grand Lodge certificate, he is told that he must never have it framed or displayed in his home or place of work, as that could constitute advertising his membership in the hope of gain. Freemasons are as human as any other group of people, and it would be dishonest to try and claim that no Freemason has ever attempted to misuse his membership. But the very few who do join for material gain, or later attempt to use their membership in that way, soon discover that they will be shunned by their fellow members, and that if they persist in their attempts, they will become subject to Masonic discipline, varying from temporary suspension of membership to total expulsion, depending on the gravity of the offence. This code of internal discipline exists not simply as a deterrent, but as a practical means of stopping Freemasonry being used for improper purposes, and therefore being brought into disrepute. This emphasis on not using Freemasonry for personal gain is one of the reasons why Freemasons have become so reticent about advertising their membership. It's an almost classic catch-22 situation. Being open about membership leads to accusations that that openness is simply for personal gain, and being reticent is taken as an admission that Freemasonry is a secret society with something to hide. Many of the accusations of Freemasonry being simply used for personal gain are based upon the mistaken belief, fostered by Freemasonry's detractors and inaccurate newspaper reports, that a Freemason is bound by his obligation to support and prefer a fellow Freemason before anyone else. A careful reading of the ritual shows how erroneous this belief is. Every Freemason is taught that his duties are to his God, to the law of the land, to his family, and to his professional or business responsibilities, and in that order. Only when he has satisfied those duties does any responsibility he might feel he has to his brethren come into play. It's a rather sad comment on society today that it is prepared to believe that an employer will employ or promote someone simply because they are a Freemason, regardless of their experience, ability, or qualifications. It's all too easy to make accusations of Masonic connivance or corruption in matters of employment or business, but it is significant that on occasions when complaints are made, testable evidence is rarely ever produced, the evidence usually consisting of innuendo and supposition. In recent years, a number of attempts have been made to blame Freemasonry for various decisions not liked by others. The London Borough of Hackney spent around £500,000 to have an eminent Queen's Counsel investigate Masonic corruption in the running of their borough. They were not pleased when his report, in which he acknowledged unprecedented assistance from Grand Lodge, showed no evidence whatsoever of Masonic corruption, but a great deal of simple mismanagement and maladministration. In 1992 and 1993, a dozen complaints of Masonic interference in local authority planning decisions were investigated by various local government ombudsmen, none of whom were Freemasons, who again found that Freemasonry was a red herring in their investigations. What annoys Freemasons is the suggestion by critics that because a very few Freemasons have erred, sometimes in a spectacular and very public way, then the institution itself is corrupt, and that the majority of its members, if they are not misusing their membership, are at least capable of doing so. Even the late Stephen Knight, in both his book The Brotherhood and in his appearance on Radio 4's Tuesday Call, readily admitted that because one Freemason misused or attempted to misuse his membership, that did not mean that the craft itself was corrupt. The popular belief that Freemasons go around giving odd signs and handshakes to identify each other is another distortion and legend. The traditional modes of recognition are simply used as a means of testing a stranger visiting a lodge where he is not known to any of the members. I can honestly say that in 24 years of membership, I have never come across anyone at a non-Masonic gathering who has attempted in this way to signify that he was a Freemason. There have been a few occasions when, because of an odd turn of phrase occurring in a conversation, I've suspected that someone might be a Freemason, but this is simply because Freemasonry, like the armed forces, the professions and many vocations, has its own terminology and phraseology, which with usage becomes unconsciously part of a Freemason's normal language and is used in general conversation without any deliberate intention of using it as a signal to other Freemasons. Freemasonry entered the realms of conspiracy theory largely as a result of claims by two contemporary writers, Robeson and Barrowell, that the French Revolution was hatched in French Masonic lodges. As a result, Freemasonry has subsequently been held responsible for the American War of Independence, the Paris Commune of 1870, the South American revolutionary movements of the 19th century, the Russian Revolution, and the First World War. These claims have been based upon the fact that some participants in the events were, or were claimed to be, Freemasons, totally ignoring the fact that in most cases there were Freemasons on both sides. The belief that Continental Freemasonry was a radical political movement arose from the autocratic and strictly stratified social structure of Europe in the 18th century, to the rulers of which the Masonic ideals of fraternity, equality, and toleration were anathema, resulting in Freemasonry being banned at various times in Austria, Spain, Portugal, the Austrian Netherlands, Russia, and parts of Germany and Italy. Because of different political and social structures, Freemasonry never suffered from government intervention in England. The nearest it came was in 1799, when the Unlawful Societies Act was passed, banning societies which required their members to take oaths. In its original form, it would have effectively prevented any Masonic lodges meeting. As a result of the leaders of both Grand Lodges in England explaining to the Prime Minister the nature of Freemasonry and how it was both a supporter of the law and the throne, and was in turn supported by members of the Royal House, Freemasonry was specifically exempted from the provisions of the Act. The exemption was conditional upon each Lodge Secretary annually providing to his local clerk of the peace a return of the members of his lodge. This provision remained in force until it was removed by Parliament in 1967 as part of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, one of those ragbag acts beloved of parliamentary lawyers in which a host of obsolete acts or provisions resulting from acts are rescinded in one large sweep. Although Freemasonry was thus recognised as a respecter and supporter of lawfully constituted authority, this did not prevent the conspiracy theorists from weaving their fanciful tales of it being a vast and secretive network, manipulating government and the law in all their forms and at all levels. There have even been claims that Freemasonry is an arm of the intelligence service and has been infiltrated by agents of foreign intelligence services. The conspiracy theorists base their claims on three false premises: that because lodges meet in private, they are therefore secret and provide scope for plotting and corruption; that Freemasons are bound to support each other, regardless of the circumstances, and to promulgate Masonic views; that the secret registers of Freemasonry give the rulers of Freemasonry and individual Freemasons access to a vast network of the population, by which means they can manipulate and control society. The facts are somewhat more mundane. As was stated a little earlier, Freemasons do not meet in secret. Meetings are private, but as an anti-Masonic element in Britain demonstrated, it's a simple matter to set up a video camera outside a Masonic hall and film the secret Masons arriving for their meetings. Although conspiracy theorists will not accept that no business other than Masonic business is transacted at lodge meetings, and even if admitted to see for themselves, would more than likely claim that the meeting had been fixed for their attendance, it's a simple fact that Masonic meetings are taken up with the working the ceremonies and the normal business required for the well-running of any society or club. There is simply no time available to get up to any of the machinations claimed by the detractors of Freemasonry. The total ban on the discussion of politics, religion, or any other non-Masonic subject is rigidly adhered to. As has already been explained, Freemasons are not bound to support each other regardless of the circumstances. They are bound to put their religious, civil, civic, and family duties before any obligations they might feel towards another Freemason. As the present Grand Secretary has publicly said on a number of occasions, Freemasonry is as interested as the police, local authorities, or any other body in finding provable evidence that Freemasons have misused their membership so that the necessary Masonic disciplinary action can be taken. Too often, however, such allegations are so vague and third-hand, or are based on a fallacious equation that because X, Y, and Z are Freemasons, therefore collusion must have taken place, that they are impossible to investigate. There is also a complete misunderstanding of the authority conferred by rank in Freemasonry. The master of a lodge only has authority within the lodge, and the members only owe allegiance to him within the lodge. His authority does not extend outside the meetings of the lodge. Freemasons are so conversant with this situation that they have found it difficult to understand why, particularly in the areas of local government and the police, concern has been expressed that those who are in a superior position in their professional lives are occasionally in a subordinate position to their professional juniors in a Masonic situation. To those involved, there is no conflict, as the two facets of their lives are separate and distinct and do not impinge upon one another. The registers of Grand Lodge contain very little personal information concerning members. For the majority of members, it is simply their age, occupation, and some indication of their address at the time of their initiation, or of their subsequently joining additional lodges, together with the date of cessation of membership. It is only in the case of Grand Officers, Provincial and District Grand Secretaries, and Lodge Secretaries that up-to-date information is kept concerning addresses, for the simple reason that they have to be sent agendas for Grand Lodge meetings and other administrative papers from time to time. It's not possible to tell from the registers, family relationships between members, or a member's religious, political, or other views, since they are not relevant to their membership. As the registers are kept by hand and by lodge, it is not even possible to say how many members of a particular profession are Freemasons. It cannot be overemphasized that provided a candidate has a belief in a supreme being, neither Grand Lodge nor its individual lodges has any interest or any reason to be interested in an individual member's religious or political beliefs or occupation or his membership of any other societies. Freemasonry has always refused to express any opinion on religious, political, or social matters, simply because there is no collective opinion, and none has ever been allowed to develop. From the diversity of its membership, Freemasonry represents a wide spectrum of the society in which it exists, and must therefore necessarily encompass a wide cross-section of beliefs and attitudes. Those beliefs and attitudes, however, are personal to the individual who holds them, and do not form any part of Freemasonry. For Freemasonry to express any opinion on such matters would offend against its basis of toleration, and would inevitably alienate sections of its members. Freemasonry was born in a period of great intolerance, when differences of views on politics and religion eventually led to civil war. In the final words of the first of the ancient charges, its purpose was to be a centre of union between good men and true, and the happy means of conciliating friendships amongst those who must otherwise have remained at a perpetual distance. If, then, Freemasonry is not a religion, a political force, or a pressure group, and if its members do not receive any material gain from their membership, the questions might properly be asked: why has it survived for so long, and why do so many seek initiation and continue their membership? The simple answer is that Freemasons enjoy their Freemasonry. That enjoyment arises and continues for a number of different reasons. To some, it's the pure enjoyment of fellowship in an atmosphere in which they can temporarily forget the problems of modern life. Others gain a real enjoyment and satisfaction from performing ritual and from seeing others perform it well. To many, the principles of Freemasonry provide a framework to guide their lives, and in many cases lead those who have perhaps been only nominally members of their religion back to full membership of it. To some, it provides the only opportunity they ever have, if they reach the master's chair, of organising and running a meeting, and as such can be said to be character building. But above all, it is the basic appeal of the principles of Freemasonry which motivate their continuing membership. It is often forgotten that membership of Freemasonry is voluntary. No one has to join, no one is coerced into joining, and the candidate has to make the first approach. After initiation, a member is at complete liberty to withdraw at any time. That so many remain in membership and derive enjoyment and satisfaction from it without any material gain is one of Freemasonry's strengths. So many other organisations, with origins similar to or based upon Freemasonry, eventually failed because, unlike Freemasonry, they became partisan and materialistic, leading to their being fragmented by factions and ultimately collapsing. By remaining true to its basic principles, but having the capacity to adapt its practices to the changing society in which it exists, Freemasonry has not only survived, but has done so on a scale which could not have been envisaged by the unknown men who came together to found it over 400 years ago.